Guys, welcome to the J. Scott Outdoors podcast. I want to get right to this episode. Before we do, I want to thank you guys for listening to this podcast. I want to let you know the best way to reach out to me is probably an email at jscottoutdoors@gmail.com or through my Instagram account at jscottoutdoors. Just send me a direct message. I want to thank GoHunt.com. They are the title sponsor and have been since the inception of my podcast in 2015. You guys know Cody Nelson, my friend, the glassing guru, the optics authority. They're the optics manager at GoHunt.com. If you guys have any optics needs, any tripod, any glassing questions, you can reach out to Cody directly at 602-399-3699. You can text or call him. That is his cell phone. You can also reach him at 702-847-8747. You can email optics@gohunt.com. Make sure to always use, whether ordering online or if you're calling and call Cody direct, use the J. Scott promo code. You're going to get a 10% discount. Also, you get a 10% discount at the Go Hunt Insider, which has incredible mapping now with the Go Hunt maps. It also has amazing draw odds and strategy articles, which is super important this spring going into application season. Go check it out, gohunt.com/jscott. And if you use the J. Scott promo code, you're going to get a $50 Go Hunt gear shop gift card when you sign up just by using the J. Scott promo code. I also want to thank Kuyu Ultralight Hunting. I've been using Kuyu gear since 2010 when the company started. They're based out of California. My late friend Jason Harrison was the founder of that company, and since Jason's passing, the company has just continued to push the bar of excellence and innovation. Go to Kuyu, that's KUIU.com. You can order. It's a direct-to-consumer website. They also have a retail store in Dallas, Texas, as well as the headquarters in Dixon, California. Go to Kuyu, KUIU.com to order. I also want to thank Phonescope.com. Cheston and his guys over there at Phonescope make the best digiscoping adapters for your binos or for your spotting scope. Use the JScott24 promo code and get a 10% discount on all orders. Guys, let's get right to this episode. Again, I appreciate you tuning in, and God bless.
Welcome to the J. Scott Outdoors podcast. Today we've got Chris Rowe of Rowe Hunting Resources. And I'm excited to have Chris on today. This is a part two series here of roosting strategies for Western turkeys. In the prior part one episode, we covered scouting turkeys here in the Western U.S. And Chris, it's always nice to have you. How you doing, buddy?
Doing all right, my friend. How you been?
Good. Doing just great. I'm looking forward to talking about roosting turkeys here. So let's just dive right into it. Talking about hunting in Western U.S., roosting, in my mind, I think roosting turkeys is one of those things that some people do not put enough time into. And for me, it's probably the most important thing to know how to do well when you're hunting turkeys out west. Because, you know, I have hunters that come hunt with me for Goulds and Merriams, and they place very little emphasis on roosting, because where they hunt back east or wherever, they say that the birds roost in the same spots all the time. And I kind of just shake my head, because our birds out west, in my mind, don't roost in the same tree every night. They don't roost in the same area sometimes every night. Sometimes they'll be on the same ridge, but I find these birds move around a lot. They cover a lot of ground throughout the day, and you know, they may cover 2 miles in a day and then, you know, loop back and roost wherever they're closest to when it gets dark. Yes, I think you can find predominant roosting areas, but for me, I'm curious about your experience. It's rare that they roost in the same tree every day.
Well, I agree with that, and to kind of go next step beyond that, people need to realize that in some of these mountain habitats, you know, I think we touched on it in part one, you might not have a huge population of birds. And so they're going to be in these pockets where, you know, out here on the river bottoms, you know, for Rios, I can get up on a hill, and if it's a calm morning, I can literally hear more than a mile, 360 degrees around me, and I can hear birds all over the place. Whereas in the mountains, man, I might be just dealing with one pocket of birds. And depending on what the terrain is like, you might not even have a clue in the world that they're there. Yeah, we went and we did all the scouting. We found tracks. We found droppings. We found all that. But if you're not out there trying to roost them and trying to figure out exactly where they are, you're going to be looking for a needle in a haystack when it comes time to get ready to set up and actually work them. So I do think that people need to spend time out there early mornings, late evenings, listening, getting on them, you know, getting on places where it gives you a good vantage point to listen multiple different directions, multiple different drainages and such. But yeah, I think people do. I think people need to get out there and listen and try to roost birds. And I agree with what you just said. A lot of times they will use the same. Now, sometimes they'll use the same trees. If the habitat is such to where you've only got one or two big mature ponderosas in a particular drainage or mountainside, well, I can, yeah, there, that's where they're going to be, period, because that's the best roost spots. But, you know, if I go down to say, well, whether it's Rampart Range or if I go down to southwestern Colorado on the Uncompahgre Plateau, the entire mountainside is made up of giant ponderosa pines. Then yeah, same thing. They're going to be, they will roost in a general area, but they may or may not be in the exact same tree that they were in the night before or the day before or whatever. And quite honestly, I've actually found in places where they actually have a daily cycle. So, and you know, if I look at day one, they're in spot A, day two, they're in spot B, day three, they're in spot C. Well, all of a sudden day four, they're back in spot A. They do a big round robin loop across the landscape. And if you're not out there roosting, you know, multiple times and sitting there and listening to that, you'd never pick up on that movement pattern.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I love the Roe Hunting Resources Turkey module because you cover a lot of this stuff. And I encourage the listeners out there to check out Chris's turkey module where he's going over a lot of this different you know, all these different things in talking about roosting and talking about their travel patterns and what have you. Looking at our outline here, I want to talk about a few things and then have you comment on them. Turkeys roost primarily in ponderosa pines. Now, I'm talking mainly about Merriam's turkeys. There are Rios in California, and they like those Norfolk pines. They like, it's not a ponderosa, but it's another type of pine tree. A lot of times those Rios like to roost, you know, over little small creeks. I find that Merriam's like to roost, you know, in ponderosa pines. They like to roost on east-facing ridges. That doesn't mean that all birds are going to roost on east-facing ridges, and we can talk about why birds roost a lot of times on east-facing ridges. Public land birds rarely roost in the same exact tree, but often roost in the same general areas. I like to look for big contour breaks and ridge lines. Ridge lines are prime roosting areas, and we can talk about why they're prime roosting areas. And in finding roosted birds, I like to walk long ridges and listen off both sides just as the turkeys do. So when you're looking at your topo maps or you're looking at new areas where you're going to hunt, I'm going to find maybe a place where a road, you know, kind of lips out on a ridge and then turns back where you could just walk that ridge out where it's pretty steep on both sides. And like what you were saying earlier, that gives me the ability to walk a ridge line. So I'm covering country and I can listen now into two different drainages. And if I'm on a predominant ridge, sometimes that allows me to have enough height and elevation that not only can I listen off both sides, but then there's other feeder canyons and such where I can hear at a long distance, and I'm basically taking inventory of where those birds are roosted. I like to research topo maps and use Google Earth to find good potential roosting areas. You got any thoughts on that?
Yeah. There's piles. Let's start. I think what we best do is just go right back to your list that you read and just start picking them apart one at a time, because there's so much information in there that we can dive into that people ought to kind of really know. You know, you talked about primarily roosting in ponderosa pines. Well, absolutely. And most of the time that is just because of the nature of the habitat they live in. I mean, a lot of these western areas are more arid, and so the ponderosa pine is the most predominant forest type. But the beautiful thing about ponderosa pines is they grow and they have these just big horizontal limbs. And so when you say they roost in ponderosa pines, absolutely. But what I would suggest people also do is kind of take a look at the age structure of those ponderosa pines. If you look across the landscape, you look across a mountainside, there are going to be areas where you have really, really old, big, mature trees. And then you're going to have areas that have maybe younger trees, maybe more thicker patches of trees. All things being equal, if water is nearby, if food is nearby, and there's a variety of different terrain, and you have mixes of big mature ponderosa pines versus small, younger age class ponderosa pine, in my experience, most of the time, you're going to find those birds in those bigger trees. Oftentimes,
why?
Well, because oftentimes, the bigger trees are going to have bigger limbs, and a bigger limb, it just holds more birds, and it's a lot easier for that bird to grab his feet onto and lock in at night. If you watch a bird, if you watch how a bird, you know, grabs and engages a limb, they're going to wrap their feet around that limb, and then when they settle in, when they basically squat down and set their breastbone on that limb, they squat down, well, the tendons and everything pull those feet tight, okay, and it just helps them lock in on that limb that night. Well, the smaller the limb, yeah, they can lock into it, but the more it's going to move with the breeze and the more it's going to move as they move or other birds are up there. So these big limbs allow them to lock on and just get in comfortable and are very secure during the night. But the other
thing, it's a more stable platform, I
absolutely
think,
but the other thing that oftentimes it does, it means you'll get these big giant ponderosas. Ponderosa, and I don't need to get into a silviculture or, you know, tree biology lesson, but big ponderosas like a lot of light. And big ponderosas like that get big like that because they're more open and they have more open habitats. Well, a lot of times, if you have those giant ponderosas, there's more spacing between those trees. And it's a lot more open under those trees, which means it's a heck of a lot easier for that bird to jump up and fly up and get up into that tree. So for a variety of reasons, a lot of times they're going to be roosting in those big mature trees. Now, that's not to say they're not going to roost in smaller trees, especially if that's all the type of trees that are in the area. They're going to make do with what they've got. But if they have the choice, and if I'm scouting, and I get up on a ridge and I look across the other side, I'm going to take a look with my naked eye, and I'm also going to take a look with my binoculars, and I'm going to pick out those areas that have those giant ponderosa pines, because that's where I'm going to go over and start looking, because I have a feeling that's where they're going to come in and roost.
Absolutely.
Now,
talk to me about – go ahead.
I was just going to go to your next point. You said you're as far as east-facing ridges.
Yep.
I agree with that. Two, however, I will just qualify it and say, I think the reason why you'll find birds on those east-facing ridges is just because they want to be able to, they roost in places where they catch that morning sunlight. And so if you have a valley that runs east-west, okay, which means your slopes are north-facing or south-facing, okay, they may not be able to roost on a quote-unquote technical east face per se, but they're going to find a knob. They're going to find a place where, generally speaking, they're going to catch that first morning sunlight. And with that, one thing that I always – and I do not have this on my webpage. I need to put this on there. But one thing that I always kind of demonstrated for people during seminars. If you take your hand, doesn't matter, right hand, left hand, doesn't matter, and flatten it out, put all your fingers together and make it like flat as a pancake, okay? Stiff and flat as a pancake. You can see where you're the back of your hand, if you're looking at the back of your hand, if you can see where the back of your hand meets and meets your fingers, those knuckles where that where your fingers start. If you keep your fingers flat and you bend your hand at those knuckles, and so you basically kind of make an A-frame with your hand. So your fingers are straight together, and then the back of your hand is flat, and it's kind of got your knuckles. Those knuckles create essentially a ridgeline. If you look at both sides of your hand, on one side of your hand, the back of your hand is kind of big and flat, and all you have is that one prominent ridge of your knuckles, versus on your finger side of your hand, you've got all the, that's why the people call them finger ridges. If you look at all your fingers, each of those fingers can be its own little ridge, and in between your fingers, where your fingers touch, that's the valley between it. In the mountains, especially in Merriam's habitat, you could come across, if you're looking at your hand, you can come across both of those scenarios. Places where you have big, wide open, flat surfaces with one prominent ridge, kind of like the back of your hand, or you can end up with areas that have a lot of finger ridges, a lot of little valleys, little drainages, kind of like the finger side of your hand. Well, my experience, if you're dealing with habitats that are like the back of your hand, where you have one single prominent ridge, a lot of times those birds are going to be roosted towards the top of that ridge, if not on top of the ridge. However, on those places where you have the little finger ridges, like the finger side of your hand, in my experience, the birds roost most of the time off of the top, not on the top of the main ridge, but rather just off, maybe three quarters of the way up the slope, or just, maybe a quarter way off the top, but just off the top of the main ridge, but on top of one of those little finger ridges.
Why?
I think it's my opinion, but I have seen where the birds will climb to the tippy top of that ridge. And if you look at the terrain, as the slope falls away from you, you can have a 60, 70 foot tall giant tree. The base of that tree might be 50, 100 yards or whatever down the slope. But the tops of the trees are just literally straight out in front of you. And so the birds, they don't have to fly up that high. They just literally jump, flap, flap, and glide, and they fly laterally and just can kind of land right in the tops of the trees. It's very easy. They're lazy. Likewise, in the morning, when they go to pitch out, they don't have to fly out and go way down to the valley. Sometimes they will. They'll go way down to the valley bottom. But a lot of times what they'll end up doing is they'll just pitch out, and they'll pitch out and land the nearest spot on the ground, which is just – right, not at the base of the tree, it's just right there laterally, upslope a little bit. So it's just the shortest distance between two points, so to speak. And a lot of times that they will, in my opinion, the reason why they choose those, whether it's an east-facing slope, or say, for instance, you take your hand and that main ridge, that main knuckle ridge, maybe that, again, is running east-west, they will favor, if it's they're on a finger ridge, they will favor the little knobs that are kind of more on that east side, because in the morning as that sun comes up and lights the whole surrounding area, those east-facing aspects or those openings that are getting the first early morning light brighten up earlier, which means they can see it better, they can determine whether there's predators there, and for safety reasons, it gives them the first place to pitch out that offers them the best visibility so they can make sure they pitch out in a spot where it doesn't have any predators. So, I don't know.
Couldn't agree more. And if you we're not going to talk about it now, but make a note that if you're looking for tactical areas to find turkeys for an afternoon, evening hunt, finding those areas that Chris, I couldn't have said it any better than what you said, but if you're looking for where do I go in the evening, find those places where Chris is just describing with the hand, where the part that's towards you is kind of a big flat open ridge and the backside is a bunch of fingers. Where do I want to be at 5 o'clock in the evening? I want to be up there on that ridge. So I'm catching birds that are going to come to the top of the ridge to pitch and fly, you know, down off that ridge into their roost tree. Well, they got to get to the top first to fly down in there. And they're either going to walk up those finger ridges or they're going to come up the flat ridge, but they're going to make it to the top. So a good place, in my opinion, to be hunting, you know, 5 o'clock till dark in states that allow hunting in the evening, I'm going to be on those ridge lines where I think those turkeys are going to be to pitch from there into their roostery.
Yeah.
I'm going to have the decoy set up and I'm going to be doing my calling periodically to try and catch those birds that are down in the low areas loafing, and then they make their big move from, you know, there's a time frame like before dark where they make a big move, in my opinion, up to a high ridge to then coast down into their tree. And I've shot a lot of birds in the last hour of light because of being in those places where they like to pitch into their roostery.
Yeah, and I know you said you didn't want to talk about it, but I don't want to forget about this tidbit. And what you said there, you know, allows you to hunt till dark. Now, some states, the main states that I am familiar with West, it's 30 minutes before sunrise until sunset, which means the sun hits the horizon, but you've still got that 30 minutes of light, if you will, available. Well, you nailed it. Sometimes they'll make that last scramble move. They'll be down low, loafing somewhere. I have seen where birds don't make that move until literally the last 15 minutes of daylight or last 10 minutes of daylight. They just make a mad scramble up the mountain. But by all means, they're going to make that move up. So yeah, even if you can't hunt until dark, if you have to end your hunt 30 minutes or basically at sunset, I'm still going to set up there. I'm still going to put my decoys up there. I'm still going to call from there, because that's where the birds want to go anyway. That's where they're going to be. So get there. And if you know, say they are in the bottom of the valley and you know that, okay, then maybe set halfway between. But regardless, you know, most of the time, in general, they're going to be making a move up. So don't handicap yourself by staying at the bottom until dark and then wonder why the birds aren't coming to you. Well, because they've got to go to the top of the mountain. They want to go up.
Absolutely. Let's take a break here.
Have you guys heard about PhoneScope? PhoneScope is a privately held company that makes custom molded, precisely engineered smartphone digiscoping adapters. Photographing wildlife has never been easier. Take digiscoping photos and videos from your smartphone and share them with your friends. PhoneScope stands behind their product with a 100% money-back guarantee. PhoneScope is the future of digiscoping. Get yours now. Use the JScott16 promo code and receive 10% discount on all purchases. Check them out at PhoneScope, that's PhoneScope.com, or on Instagram at PhoneScope. Wilderness Athlete is committed to improving the health and quality of life for the outdoor athlete by providing field-tested, scientifically validated nutrition and sports performance products. Check them out at wildernessathlete.com and use the JScott promo code to receive 10% off any order.
Okay, I know we've still got a few talks about contour breaks and ridge lines and what have you, but we can dive into that, but let's cover some ground here on how to roost birds.
Sure.
2 hours before it gets dark, I'll be on those ridge lines like I talked about, where I think turkeys are going to be, and I'm going to be listening. I'm going to be still. I'm walking quietly. It's important that we can hear birds and we don't spook birds. People that go out with me, they kind of
some people frown on it because I don't like to walk down a long ridgeline just talking to my buddy back and forth because birds can hear from a long distance away. So a lot of times, you know, once I leave the truck, it's, you know, whisper mode. And anybody that's hunted with me, my nephews, they've learned real quick that you don't just yell out, "Hey, uncle," you know, you got to be quiet when you're in these areas because you may have a bird that's, you know, 100 yards in front of you. You don't know it, but they hear you and off they go. So that's one thing. Oftentimes we'll use a box call to try and strike a bird. And the reason for that is I'm up on a ridge line and a box call carries, the sound carries a long ways. And if I strike a bird and he gobbles, he's down in the bottom, a lot of times I'll just shut up. If it's the night before the hunt, say the hunt hasn't even started, I don't want to get a bird all worked up. I don't really even want him coming to my call. I'm just trying to locate turkeys. At that point, I'll probably just sit, and I'll just sit and wait and listen and listen. And I've roosted a lot of birds where I called one time, and they gobble their brains out. I never call again. The next thing I know, they're 40 yards from me, looking all around. I don't make another peep, and then I just watch them walk off, you know, keep my binos on them. I stay put. Sometimes I just let them walk off, and then I listen to them fly up, and that bird's roosted. So the next morning I can get right in there on that exact spot. I do a lot more listening than calling. I try and cover country. Our goal is to be in the best spot where we think the birds will be the last 30 minutes of daylight. Once we reach that prime area, I'm just sitting, listening, and observing. I'm not talking to my buddy. I'm listening. And I actually listen for birds to gobble on their way to the roost. I listen for birds, the sound of flapping wings going up to the roost. And then I listen for birds once they've reached the roost and they're in the roost. A lot of times they'll give a gobble or two and sometimes even more to let other birds know where their position is. Now, it's very common in my mind that you hear, and now I'm listening for, was it one bird? Was it two birds? Did I hear five birds? I try and actually count the amount of birds up in the tree. So I'm taking inventory of, you know, are there hens with that gobbler? Is it two gobblers alone? And I'm constantly making mental notes of what I'm observing. Chris?
All right, hold up. I'm making notes. That's the thing. That's why I enjoy talking. I mean, I do. I love these, man, because I think we have such a similar philosophy and so many things are so similar. I'm just scratching notes as you're talking because I agree with everything. I'm going to pick apart what you just said, and I'm going to touch on a couple things. Number one,
okay.
You said you like getting out there 2 hours before dark. I agree wholeheartedly, and I do like the fact.
Just to be clear, 2 hours in the afternoon before it gets dark.
Yes, yes,
right?
Yes. If we're talking about evening, listening in the evenings, yes. Okay, 2 hours. And the reason why I like that, and I agree with that, and I do that, you can, depending on the population of birds that you have and depending on the density of birds in your area, you can have two situations. Now, sometimes those two situations overlap and they do both of these. But however, sometimes you can have single toms or maybe a pair of toms that are off on their own. They do not have their own flock yet. Okay. It's not uncommon if they know that if those birds know that they want to roost in a particular area. Okay, they might not go and literally stand their little toenails right under the roost tree that they're going to fly up in. However, late afternoon, early evening, an hour or two before fly up, they oftentimes will make their way that direction and they'll be in the area and they'll just sound off because what they're doing is broadcasting and trying to say, hens, hey, I'm over here, you know, come to me. And they're just going to sound off occasionally in and around the roost site before it's even close to being time to fly up. Well, if that's the case, if you can be out there and you can hear that, bingo, baby. If you can get some binoculars on them or a spotting scope on them, and you can see where they are, or at the very least, you heard them sound off. Now you've got an hour or more to slowly make your way that direction. Again, like I said before, is you might have these isolated pockets. Some of the terrain is such, and maybe if you have a nice calm day where you don't have a lot of wind and you can hear long distance, that bird sounds off. He might be 3/4 of a mile away. Well, it's going to take you some time to navigate that terrain and get over there. Sometimes it may, the best thing you can do is go back to the truck, get in, drive around the mountain, get closer. All right. So if you're out there early, sometimes you can hear those birds sound off in and around the areas that they're going to roost in well before sunset. However, the other thing is, though, sometimes you may not. If that gobbler or group of birds is in a tight-knit group, again, I talk about this with Understanding River Bottom Rios in the elk, or excuse me, the turkey module on the website. If you have those habitats where you have a small population, and I don't want to dive into turkey biology too bad here, but sometimes those birds will stay in the same flock all winter long. So the gobblers are mixed in with the jakes, are mixed in with the hens. They all go to the same place just because the habitat is limited. Well, they know everybody. It's not like they're going to be surprised at another turkey's kind of showing up. I mean, they know everybody. And so they travel together. In those situations, they're a tight-knit group. They might not, especially pre-season, they might not gobble at all until they do get up in the tree. And he might only gobble once or twice, and that's it. Okay? So by being out there early, it gives you the opportunity to pick up on, is that gobbler off on his own? Or is or are, if there's more than one, or are they off on their own? If they're not off on their own and he is gobbling a lot before sunset, well, okay, that gives you an idea of his disposition, kind of take his temperature a little bit. And we'll, I know that on your outline, Jay, you've got that coming up here in a minute. But it gives you an idea of what his temperament is. But then by the same token, if you are out there and you're in the spot and there is nothing going on until all of a sudden, yeah, I mean, it's just about dark and all of a sudden you hear and a bird fly up. And you're like, wait a minute, that sounds like wings. And then all of a sudden, boom, there's one gobble. Okay, well, and especially like you said, if you're counting wing beats, you can hear multiple birds going up to roost and he doesn't say a peep until it's almost pitch black and he gobbles one time. Oh, baby. I've been able to get an indication of his disposition, or I might have a hint that, goodness gracious, he is locked down with those hens. He's not fired up. I'm going to have to be close. I'm going to have to be, you know, if I'm going to work him the next morning or whatever, I'm going to have to be very tight to that roost. And I'm probably going to end up being a situation where I'm going to have to call the entire flock with me. So it gives you an indication of what you're going to have to deal with later.
Chris, I want to add one thing to what you're saying there, which is great stuff. Let's say in that same scenario, you hear, and then boom, one gobble, and he waits till right when it's dark. And I'm thinking, okay, hens, I'm thinking, okay, gobbler, I'm thinking, it's going to be tough in the morning. Now, same situation, across the drainage, I can eyeball a ridge across that I've been sitting by my tree, I've been looking where I have vantage, waiting for this to happen. This bird's roosted pretty close to me. I've been glassing down there across the drainage, and I see that, oh, there's a finger ridge, and it's straight across from me. All of a sudden, across the ridge, I hear, gobble, 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 gobble. Gobble, 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 just uncontrollably gobbling. That's usually going to tell me that, okay, the gobbler that's kind of the boss is over here with the hens. The gobbler that's across the way, now I'm going to be trying to glass that bird in the tree and say, is that a, he sounds like he's really broadcasting his gobble. He's much more eager than this bird is here that already has hens. Maybe I should then set up on the bird across the drainage that's gobbling his brains out, or maybe I should set up in the bottom between these groups of birds.
a lot of times I'm going to pick the bird that sounds more desperate, quote unquote, or more eager than the bird that's gobbled one time with hens. Give me your thoughts.
I am scrambling right now. Okay, here we go. If folks, I mean, and I'm not trying to pull people, this enhances what you're talking about right now. I have a video on our YouTube channel. It's Through the Season. I've got a video series called Through the Seasons, okay, where it's just my hunting videos. They're mostly education-based, but there's one called, if you go to YouTube, it's Big New Mexico Merriam's Turkey, okay? Dude, you're nailing it. What you're talking about right now is literally the heart and soul of that episode. It's episode 3. I talk about that exact thing, except I flip it. I do the exact opposite. What you just talked about, you've got one bird on one side of the mountain, or in one end of the valley, and you hear multiple fly-ups, and he waits and he gobbles once. But over here on this other side of the valley, or down this valley, the birds are just rocking. You're absolutely right. Those birds that are rocking are probably going to be a little bit easier to call the next morning. But I can almost bet you dollars to donuts, the one bird with the hens, or the one bird that just sounds off and does it once, he is a mature bird, he's an old bird, he's a dominant bird, and I'll bet you he's a giant.
Yeah,
and so
big old spurs.
And here's the other thing, and I talk about this in that video. All right, the thing is if we're talking about public land. Now I know you know you've got where you outfit on some of your ranches. You're the only people that you need to deal with most of the time. But if we're talking about public land, which a lot of Western turkey hunters are going to be dealing with, here's where you start getting savvy with how you start playing the birds.
I know what's coming and I like it.
Exactly. So, and in that video, okay, again, Big New Mexico Merriam's Turkey, put that into YouTube. It's the Roe Hunting Resources channel. Watch it, because I talk about this. Anybody else that's listening and trying to roost birds, they're going to hear they're going to hear the turkeys that are just rocking and going crazy. Okay. Well, guess where they're going to go in the morning? Yep. They're going to go after the birds that are rocking. Well, if you want to go after the birds that are rocking because it sounds awesome and they're desperate and they want company and you think they're going to be easier to call, which they probably will, well, understand that every other hunter is probably going to do the same thing. So next morning, you're going to have like 3 or 4 guys all piled around this one group of birds. Whereas, if you've spent time practicing your calls, well, I know, Jay, we're going to get into this here in a minute, but if you spend your time with, you know, practicing your calls and you can call decently and you've got a good decoy setup, blah, 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 and you get your setups right, if you choose the bird that gobbles once, you're going to have him by – you're the only hunter that's going to be on that bird. And so you literally can look across that landscape, listen across the landscape, hear the different birds going. And if you know you've got other turkey hunters in that area, you know where they're going to go. Skip the birds that are going crazy. Go after the one that just sounds off once. Because here's the beautiful thing about it. If you say, and again, this is why I love the game. This is why I just absolutely love turkey hunting and likewise elk hunting, because of the game, the mental strategy, the chess match about the whole thing. If you go after the one that sounded off by him just once and he's got the hens, if you get in there and work him in the morning, you very well, most likely are going to be the only hunter on that bird. So you can hunt him and work him in a relaxed state and how he needs to be worked without any pressure that, oh, geez, you know, someone else, I've got to compete with another hunter. If it works and you call him in, great, kill him, boom, you just killed the most dominant bird on that mountain, most likely. But here's the thing, if it doesn't work and those other hunters don't kill every single one of those other eager turkeys, which they probably aren't going to, those other eager turkeys are probably going to be running the ridgeline all day long you'll have a chance at them later.
And or they're going to come because they know the hens are over where you're at. They're probably going to fly over across the canyon and come up to your setup. Even if your dominant bird works off with the hens, you make one turkey call and probably those eager beavers are probably going to come storming in.
They're headed there anyway.
Let's take a quick break right here. This is great stuff.
Utah Hydrographics is in the water transfer printing service, and they are open to whatever you can dream up. Choose from a wide range of camo patterns, designs, and colors. Whether it's guns, bows, tools, rifle stocks, vehicles, steering wheels, fenders, dashboards, paint guns, fishing rods, cups, tripods, watches, knife grips, helmets for a local sports team or for your motorcycle, picture frames, mailbox, animal skulls, you name it, they can probably do it. Utah Hydrographics loves taking things that are general looking and turns them into something that looks fantastic and eye-popping. Give them a call and see what they can do for you and receive up to a 10% discount by using the JScott16 promo code. Visit them at UtahHydrographics.com or on Instagram at Utah Hydrographics. Whether you are interested in elk, deer, antelope, bighorn sheep, or moose, Western Hunter and Elk Hunter magazines will bring the adventure to your mailbox. These publications feature articles on the finest hunting gear, tips and tactics from experienced hunters, field judging trophies, glassing techniques, calling strategies, and much more. To become a more knowledgeable and skilled hunter, subscribe today. Go to westernhunter.net/JScott and enter your email address for a chance to win a $1,500 credit towards any Swarovski product.
Yeah, I mean, Chris, I totally get what you're saying, and I think I'll take one more strategy step in this in roosting birds one step further to exactly what you're saying. And I remember that video you're talking about. I loved that through the seasons, that whole New Mexico. You did a bunch of great hunts and some great video on that New Mexico hunt. Going back to what I said before, put yourself in the situation where you've got the wing flaps, you hear the one bird gobble, and then across the drainage you hear gobble, 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 and you hear very eager birds. Another thing that I'm going to be doing on public land is I am listening, I am glassing, I am staying in that spot till dark. I am looking for headlights or headlamps walking out on the opposite ridge where the eager beavers are. I'm listening for abnormal coyote howls. I'm listening for any type of owl hoots that I can delineate or determine that is a hunter that's calling to those eager beavers. Yep. And even more than that, I'm listening after dark for vehicles to be driving from that area, like they parked up on that opposite ridge line and now they're driving their quad and they've started and they're driving off. Because a lot of times if you just stay put,
you got it,
you can see. Now in the situation where, and I'll even wait till dark and then I'll even go back, you know, hike back in the dark, get to my truck, drive over to the other ridge line, look in the, has there been anybody that's pulled off? Is there any vehicle here? Can I determine at all if there's been anybody here? If the answer is I stayed there till dark and nobody's around, then I have the dilemma. Do I go after the bird that's got the hens that gobbled once that I know exactly where it is? Or do I go after the eager beavers? And sometimes I would do one or the other. But if I'm just trying to kill a turkey, if I can go after an eager beaver that's going to come storming in the first peep I make, usually that's what I'm going to do. But you make a great point that when you're hunting public land, a lot of times not only are you hunting birds, but you're also not hunting people, but you're people managing your management with other hunters. And so, you know, you have to, you know, people that go roost with me, they sometimes shake their head and they're like, I can't believe you go into this much detail for a bird. And we're not going to get back to camp now till 10 o'clock at night. And we just skipped dinner because you want to kill a bird so bad in the morning. You're over checking, okay, is there anybody else camped on that ridge? Is there anybody else parked on that ridge? You know, and trying to ascertain every bit of information that I can to make a decision. Do I go after the bird with hens? Do I go after the eager beaver? So, I mean,
yeah.
great stuff there, Chris.
Well, and I think you made a good point there when your hunter management, your strategy management, basically trying to figure out what you want to do. I guess I will say that if the other thing too, well, number one, no, for me, I don't even know how many turkeys I've killed. I really don't. I've lost track. And that's not bragging. It just means I've killed a lot of turkeys. I just love it.
Right. And to me, to take that a step further, I've never been one to have to say I've killed 30 birds.
Yeah, yeah.
I've killed 100 birds. Yeah. I've killed 205 birds. Yeah. And some people do, and that's fine.
Oh, I'll flat out tell you, there's people that killed way more turkeys than I have. I mean, was it North Dakota or South Dakota? You can kill like 83 a year or something. I don't know. It's stupid how many birds you can kill up there. And so if you live in some of these areas, like especially Nebraska, where you can kill 3 birds a year, and you know, some of these people have grown up in some of these states where you can kill, you know, 3, 4, 5 turkeys. Okay,
in Texas, you can kill 5.
Yeah,
so I mean,
of course, you're going to kill more birds than me. But I mean, on the whole, I hunted from New York to Washington State to New Mexico and Colorado and pretty much everywhere in between, and I just love it. However, I say all that because there's not a 2-year-old turkey in the world that's going to walk by me and not catch something in the face.
I agree.
It's funny. I've killed some great birds with some gigantic beards, but my nemesis, I think the biggest spurred turkey I've ever killed, I think it had 1 1/8 or 1 1/4 spurs. I see some of these people shooting these gigantic 1 1/2 spurs or whatever. I never let them get that far. It has a full fan, it's a dead bird.
I always say if it has a fan, if it has a beard, and if it's gobbling, it's in trouble.
It's in trouble, exactly. Yeah. So if I'm on public ground and I know that I have limited time in which to hunt, and just like you said, I get up there and I'm the only person on the mountain, at that point I've got the one lone gobbler gobbles once, or I've got the party over there that's just rocking and rolling. If they are literally on two sides, I mean, they're completely separate, where I have to commit one or the other. I have to make a decision and either go after one and skip the other because of the way the terrain and distance is, then yes, I'll be honest with you, probably I'm going after the ones that are rocking because I just enjoy that and I want to fill my tag. However, if those two are in close proximity to one another, say they're on the same ridge, but they're just separated by like maybe a quarter of a mile or maybe a half mile, if I have access to both and they are in close proximity to one another, then that's when I do choose the one that gobbled by himself because, like you said, Jay, they're going to move. They're probably going to – those ones that are rocking and rolling are probably going to make a move in the direction of the gobbler that has the hens and gobbled just once. They are just separated because the mature gobbler has kicked them out and they're not getting any play with the hens that gobbler has. So what they do is they will separate themselves behaviorally in the evening. They'll go roost in a separate area, gobble their brains out because what they're trying to do is to attract their own hens. If hens show up in the morning that are not part of that, the other gobbler's, you know, harem, well, then great. They'll fly down and they'll spend their time with those hens. But if those hens don't show up, if new hens don't show up, they're going to fly down, they're going to gobble, and then they're going to make a beeline over to the one that was gobbling just once anyway. They're going to go that way. So you made a good distinguishing thing there. It depends on, for me, it depends on how close those two groups, if you will, those styles of gobblers are. If they're in close proximity to one another, I'm going to make a play for the more mature bird, just for the game's sake of it, understanding that the younger birds are probably going to move my way anyway. But if they are separated across that landscape and I don't have to worry about other hunters, I'm going to go to the party. I'm going to go to the ones that are rocking and rolling, knowing full well they're probably 2-year-old birds, and I'm going to have a blast.
I love 2-year-olds.
Yeah.
Just in an effort, I know we got more to talk about, but just in an effort just to keep this moving so we get as much out of there as we can.
And then let me just skip ahead and let me touch on a couple of the other things that you had mentioned because I think there are points in there. You'd said speed walking, you know, going down those ridges and glassing and listening, and you were talking about the fact that when you go with someone, you know, it's not that enjoyable because you're not talking and you're out there for a mission. Well, again, I agree with that wholeheartedly. Here's a little bit of a tidbit for folks listening. If you are going with a partner, okay, and I don't care if that's your best buddy, hunting buddy, or if you're going out with your kids, okay, if they're young kids, have them along with you. But if they're teenage kids and they're part of the strategy session, if you will, what I do.
Guys, this concludes episode 131, part 2, Roosting Strategies with Chris Rowe of Rowe Hunting Resources. Make sure to check the next episode, part 3, episode 132, the second part of Roosting Strategies with Chris Rowe.